You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. We are back for another exciting episode. I'm with just Rachel this week. Hey, Rachel, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself, Kirk? I'm excited to be here.
I am good now, but as you'll hear in my story this week, that maybe isn't always the case. I'm going to be a little cryptic and leave it at that.
All right. I'm a little concerned.
I have a story for you. I'm going to your realm here, Rachel, the ocean.
Oh, beautiful.
And this story takes place in Hawaii because, as I had mentioned, I think on the show last week, I was there just a few weeks back. Mm-hmm. And I hinted at the time that I had a story to tell. So here it is. I was visiting Hawaii with family, and we're always looking for new things to do. And I have a teenage son, and the things he wants to do aren't always the same things that we want to do. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we, you know, go our own ways and do our own things, but we wanted to at least find one like memorable experience that we could all do together on the trip. And so my wife had researched a bunch of different ideas, and we pitched some of them to him. And the one that he thought sounded, you know, I guess it'd be okay, was swimming with rays.
And that sounds so cool.
Yeah. So my wife found this opportunity. She pitched it to me before she pitched it to him. And to be totally honest, my first instinct was that I was a bit underwhelmed by the idea. Now, you had the proper response. You're like, that's so cool.
Yeah.
I should explain that the reason I would be underwhelmed by such an experience is that I've had a bunch of experiences with rays before. As I think I've mentioned on the show, I used to work at the giant 1.2 million gallon aquarium that can be found under Mall of America.
Kirk, that is very fair, actually. Yeah, there's a lot of rays there, and you definitely have a lot of interactions with them there.
Yeah, so we did have rays there. I used to see them every day at work. I used to watch them being fed and talking to the husbandry team about that. Mm-hmm. Later on, we got some like little foot long ones. These were like some of the, I don't know, three foot ones. Mm-hmm. So they're very cool, but not super unique for me. I've also swam with rays before, or at least I guess waded in the water with them. On our honeymoon, 23 years ago, my wife and I accidentally ended up doing a swim with the rays program. We were supposed to do a kayak program in Grand Cayman, and it got canceled. And at the last minute, and they kind of forgot to tell us that no one else had signed up, so they canceled it.
Tragic.
And the tour organizers felt like really bad that they completely forgotten about us. And so they're like, well, we can do this ray. There's this ray experience instead. And we're kind of like, it's not really what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. We went and did it. And it's very cool. You basically go and you stand out on a sandbar. And I think they kind of chum the waters a bit. And these rays come like swimming in. They're swimming all around you. Some people would be absolutely terrified. But they're like swimming.
I think that sounds so cool.
They're swimming like between your legs even sometimes. This is only in a couple of feet of water. Very cool.
I would have so much fun with this.
Right. So I'd done this whole swim with rays thing before, but I was like, well, this would be a cool experience for, our son to have. And I thought I had done this before, but there's a catch here.
Mm-hmm.
With this, you get to swim with them at night. And you aren't standing on a sandbar. You're holding onto a floating platform with lights shining down and lighting them up as they swim underneath you. And I'm like, okay, that sounds really cool. Like you got a snorkel mask on and you're looking down and watching them and stuff. And I talked to our son and he's like, yeah, that'd be kind of cool. We should do that. Great. So the evening comes and we're getting ready to go, but it was like really, really windy that day. There are even some advisories saying that there was going to be like 7-foot waves in some areas. So we're kind of like, is this still even going to go on? And we checked with the tour company and they're like, oh yeah, no, it's totally safe. It's going to be fine. Still a go. We're in kind of a sheltered area. Be fine. Perfect. Great. Okay. So we show up and we get on this boat and we do not have to go far. They were saying that it was like a 7-minute boat trip. I think it was 5. Like my son was giving them a really hard time. Like, this is not 7 minutes. You guys are crazy. But I will say those 5 minutes were pretty wavy. And a few people on the boat started to feel a little kind of seasick. But I'm very hardy. And I've been on a lot of boats before. So I was not too worried. And the lead person on the boat kind of gathered everyone together to explain what we're going to do and how it all works and why they do it at this exact location. And it's really strange and really fascinating. And it goes back to the year 1971, because in that year, a hotel was built right along the coast. This is on the Big Island of Hawaii, right in Kona. And at this spot, it was kind of next to where the marina was that we left from. They built a hotel that nowadays is called the Outrigger Kona, but it was originally called the Kona Surf. And they have this bar, like a drinking bar, right down by the edge of the water. And there isn't a beach. The rocks just drop off like lava down into the ocean there. And since this hotel was named after the surf, someone thought, hey, you know, it'd be really cool to get 3 big white spotlights that like shine down onto the surf at night. So when you're in the bar having a drink, you can see the surf that the place is named after, because the water kind of breaks in the rocks there and it's pretty. So shortly after the hotel opened, they noticed that something strange was happening. At night, people would see these dark shapes moving under the water in the areas lit by the spotlights. And some brave, curious person volunteered to just jump into the black nighttime waters to find out what these dark shapes were. And they reported that they were rays that were feeding at night in these pools of light, which is super cool. And what had happened is this hotel had inadvertently created a ray feeding grounds. So what happens is during the day, plankton burrow down into the sandy bottom of the ocean. And at night, they come out, but all these plankton were attracted in large numbers to these bright lights that were shining down on the ocean all night long, every single day. And it didn't take long before the rays to figure out that this was an amazing food source and a great feeding grounds. And pretty soon people as well figured out that if they build floating platforms with lights shining directly down from them, people could hold on to them. And those lights would like attract the plankton to these little rafts, and then the rays would come right up to the rafts and you could see them up close. So that is super, super cool.
Yeah, and that's wild.
As this is all being explained to me on the boat that was rocking back and forth on the ocean, it occurs to me that the rays we had at the aquarium and the rays that we saw in Grand Cayman didn't eat plankton. They ate fish. In fact, we would cut fish up to feed the rays at work.
Uh-huh.
And the rays I was familiar with were southern rays. And they can get pretty big, 4, maybe 5 feet across at the biggest. Mm-hmm. And when the wife said, hey, we're going to see rays in the ocean, for some reason, my brain just assumed that these would also be southern stingrays.
Right.
Of course.
They're not.
I was wrong.
You are so wrong. I think I know what kind of rays they are.
Yeah, they were manta rays.
Uh-huh.
Now, Rachel, you are like a giant ocean nerd. I'm sure from you were a little girl, you were like studying all about the ocean stuff. Yeah. And I gotta be honest, I'm more of a land guy than a water guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm around fresh water a whole lot more than like being around marine water. Mm-hmm. So I never went through that obsessive phase learning about marine mammals like a lot of other people. And so I have to admit, I didn't know how big manta rays are. I've only ever seen a photo or a drawing of them, and there's usually nothing for scale in those photos. Dear listeners, manta rays are freaking huge.
Yes, they are.
Now, I would say we were about to swim with the coastal variety. There's also like a deep water variety. The coastal variety They grow to a wingspan.
But they're still pretty big.
Oh, Rachel, 10 to 18 feet.
That's
how big.
Three Rachels.
They can get, yeah. Now, for people who don't use crazy units, that's 5.5 meters at their largest. These things are enormous. And when our tour guide told us how big they would be, I wish I could have seen the look on my face because I was like, wait, what? That's they're how big? And then they explained that they were going to be coming like right next to our face.
Mm-hmm.
So these things were three times larger than I'd expected. And I'm like, oh my gosh. You think about there's these platforms, which are almost like a surfboard with handles in the side. They're not real big.
Uh-huh.
And they have these lights that look a lot like those little tap lights, kind of your under cabinet lighting, a little round light that are shining down into the water. In this case, this tour company used blue ones. And this attracts the plankton. And when these manta rays would come, they don't just swim under us, which is what I was expecting them to do. Like, oh, look, they're swimming around. This is really neat. Oh, no, 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 no. They want to get as close as possible to the light to feed.
Mm-hmm.
So they do swim under you, maybe, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 feet under you. But then all of a sudden they do a backflip and they flip upside down onto their backs and skim just inches from the lights. And keep in mind, your face is just inches from the lights. So they like,
sounds so cool.
They were right in front of your face and you're literally looking straight down into their mouths while they do this flyby. They did warn us there's no guarantees that rays will show up, but in our case, we ended up having a nearly record 10 full-size manta rays feeding just inches from our faces.
That's so cool. It was
completely strange and phenomenal, and it was an amazing experience. And it, as I was processing it, it really drove home something that is super strange that I don't think people think about that much. And it has to do with the relative size of animals based on diet.
Isn't it wild?
Yeah, because as carnivores, we're taught to think of other carnivores as being like the top of the food chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lions, tigers, wolves, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Carnivores are big, fast, smart animals. And we for sure have like a cultural bias to think of carnivores as the dominant life on Earth.
Right.
But take a look at the largest animals and you'll see they aren't carnivores. Like elephants, blue whales, whale sharks. Like, especially with whales, you've got, you know, you talked about the sperm whale, which is the largest toothed whale. And then you have like blue whales, which are the biggest. And I know this term carnivore, I mean, they eat plankton, which are animals and stuff, but they're not like these big predatory animals, I guess, that I'm going for. And then you have the biggest shark is the whale shark.
Yep.
Which, again, is a filter feeder, right? So it's like, this is amazing. And the titanosaur, the biggest dinosaur, is an herbivore. Like, all the biggest animals are herbivores or filter feeders. And I think as
easy
predators
to be able
ourselves,
to find whatever food, you know, it doesn't move.
As predators ourselves, right? Like, we think of grazing as lazy, I think. But, like, even look at a bison. They're enormous, right? Or look at the size
absolutely
of
huge.
The filter feeding manta rays. They are enormous. And I will say, and there are even larger manta rays than the ones I got to swim with. That was the coastal variety. But the giant manta ray that lives out in the ocean can get up to 7 meters or 23 feet across. And that's all
it's
just
so
feeding
big.
On teeny, tiny little plankton. So it's very effective. It's a very effective strategy that allows you to become a very large animal because you can't get that big if you're like malnourished, right? So it really is incredible. Getting to be in the water with the manta rays was for sure one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life. However, it was also one of the most singularly awful things I have done in my life. Do you remember when I said the seas were rough, Rachel?
Uh-huh, I do remember.
They got progressively rougher the longer we were out. So picture this. We are face down in surging waves, not breaking waves, but kind of up and down, like feet high. You know, we are face down looking down. So you have no point of reference, but you are being tipped back and forth and back and forth for about half an hour. while we watch these giant lit up rays doing backflips and swimming past us, which is totally messing with your frame of reference as well.
Yep.
So it was amazing what we were seeing, but it was super disorienting. What with the waves that we could feel but not see. And, you know, that's what really messes your brain up, is when what you're seeing doesn't match up with what you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
My wife tapped out and went back to the boat first. Certainly not the first person. Other people were tapping out too. But finally, she was like, I can't do it. And she went back. My son and I lasted a bit longer. But one by one, people started to come in when they'd had enough. I don't know if anybody lasted like the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I got back on the boat. I would say I might have lasted 60 seconds on the boat before I had to run to the edge and make an offering to the sea. And let me tell you, dear listener, I gained absolutely zero calories for my dinner that evening.
Yep.
I went to the far side of the boat. I let loose. And there was until there was nothing left inside. And I was not the only one. And only after I was done, because they had said, go like over to the side of the boat in the back and the front. And only after I was done did I like kind of look up in front of me in the water. And keep in mind, this is at night too, right? So we're at night.
Right.
And I look up and here's another tour company that had like drifted really close to us. And they were like pulling their folks back to their boat on their little flotilla. Mm-hmm. And I must have been, you know, chum in the water. It's not 20 feet from these people who were like face down looking at rays that had come to their lights. And I'm like, oh, good.
Oh,
I'm glad I just totally barfed. It was like someone right in the same pool as you and you're just like face down. This is fine. So that was lovely. I would say I'm not the only one. There were about 30 people on this tour. And I would say about half of them ended up losing their lunch or their dinner in this case over the side of the boat. It was getting really, really rough. We were basically thinking they probably should not have even gone out. If half of your, you know, people get like kind of seasick, but like if half of your boat is basically puking, the other half wants to, it's mm-hmm. probably a bit rough. So we get back, we wrapped up the evening, and as I headed to shore, the tour company, like organizers are like, hey, you guys, like if you felt a little motion sickness, wait 10 minutes before driving, because that can just bring it all right back.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, this was no ordinary motion sickness. I had to sit in our car. I could barely walk to the car and we had parked far away. Oh. I had to like sit in the car doing breathing exercises for a full hour
before
I could even think about letting that car move even an inch. I have never felt such bad motion sickness that lasted so long after the causative event occurred in my life. And after the 45 minute drive home, my breathing was like almost back to normal,
mm-hmm.
and I just collapsed in bed. And I think it is fair to say that I do not want to see another boat for many, many, many years. I did, like up until a year ago, like I owned a boat. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm no stranger to boats. This was awful. It was really awful. I did find out later that about 3 hours after we got off the water, the National Weather Service officially issued a gale warning and told all boats to stay off the water. So I personally think they were a little late to the party on that one because it was pretty rough out there. But the rays didn't care. They were having a lovely time feeding and we got to see it. So that's what I wanted to talk about this week. Just swimming with enormous rays at night. One of the strangest and most beautiful and memorable experiences of my life for multiple reasons. I highly recommend it, but I'll just say, be sure to pick a calm night because it would have been a different kind of memorable if it had been a calm night and my arms weren't also being like ripped out of their sockets by being jerked back and forth for half an hour on this floating raft. So
that's pretty sweet. That's awesome. That's so
yeah, cool, it was. Well, look, I've rambled enough about that. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Rachel, you got something for us too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Awesome. See you guys soon.
Welcome back, everyone. Now, when I went to college, I went to college in an agricultural school.
Yes, you did.
I did. It was a land grant university. It was really cool.
Oh, my college is also a land grant university. Look at us.
Look at us go. And one thing, when I was driving up from my house, from my home, to school, so where I went to school, I went to North Dakota State. So as you could maybe imagine, you drive up, you pass a lot of farm fields.
Oh, it's a lot of farms.
Many, many, many farm fields. And the closer I got to North Dakota, some of those farm fields, it was really cool because in like August, some of those fields are just thousands and thousands of beautiful sunflowers just
cool
following the sun.
Oh, so pretty.
They're absolutely gorgeous. And I've learned some wild things about sunflowers. So that's what we're talking about this week.
Okay? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because like, why would I talk about sunflowers, right? Like, they don't seem very strange. They're everywhere. We use the seeds to feed birds, livestock. We use them to feed ourselves. They're often really a starting flower for many, many kids to grow in like the spring or summer is like a starting type plant. Sunflowers, Kirk, they are so metal. So to give you a little bit of context, so sunflowers are a native species to the Americas. They've been cultivated by people as far back as 3000 BCE. So,
wow.
That's about 5,000 years ago.
That's a lot.
Yes. So, we've been cultivating and using them for many different types of purposes for a very, very long time.
Interesting.
Right? Like, generally speaking, nowadays, we just use them for food or for livestock, for the most part. They've been used as well as, like, very commonly, they get used for something called sun butter, which is, like, peanut butter, but with sunflower seeds rather than
peanuts.
Sure,
yeah, yeah.
Well, so
like,
pretty common.
Oil to some degree, too, I think.
Exactly. Oil as well. It's been used for the oil. You can dry the stalks and use the stalks for if the stalks get dried enough, they can be used for like, trying to think of the word. You can use them as part of like thatching and everything. Traditionally, they were actually referred to as like the fourth sister in with the three sisters. So, the three sisters, for those who don't know, were corn, beans, and squash. If you grow them all together, they all like supplement and work with each other and help make
they
sure
work
that
real
the,
well, yeah.
The nutrients in the soil and everything all work together and help each other grow, right? Well, sunflowers actually were on the north edges of the gardens as the fourth sister. Generally speaking, to allow some root fixation as well, but also like provide a little bit of shade. Anyway.
Huh.
Right? Now, so to give everyone context too, there's a lot of variety of sunflowers out there. I'm going to speak pretty generally about sunflowers. They are in a variety of sizes. Some are known as dwarf sunflowers, and they grow no taller than 3 feet.
Oh, cute.
Isn't it adorable? But others, most of them, the ones that we think about, can get up to 16 feet.
Oh my, this is like a manta ray situation all over again. 16 feet? I was picturing like 8 feet or something.
Oh,
but 16, that's double what I was thinking, Rachel.
Oh, Kirk.
Oh no, you're going bigger, aren't you?
The tallest sunflower that was grown was 30 feet and 1 inch tall. It is the Guinness
shut
World.
Up.
It was the Guinness
you
World
shut up.
Record.
What are you saying?
There was a sunflower grown that was 30 feet, 1 inch tall.
That is as tall as a three-story building.
Uh-huh. And it also has like almost six Rachels tall. Like it's literally in the Guinness World Record book.
As well, it should be. Well,
yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, it's not surprising. If you have a sunflower, this is a plant that's very sun-loving. And
they're
in plants, we see a race for
follow the sun.
Yeah, but it's a race for like who's gonna get that sunlight, who's gonna be the biggest plant. We see this in trees getting quite tall, but usually in like a and are they annuals or perennials? They're annuals,
they're
aren't they?
Annuals, yeah. So
right, so to have an annual
seeds
that grows that tall is wild.
Yeah,
especially if it's not in like a tropical location as well.
I don't believe it was actually.
Well, I just mean even if that one was, like, sunflowers in general are like a pretty temperate species. So like,
yeah,
that's, you don't find them in like the jungle.
No. So the world's tallest sunflower is actually grown in Germany.
Okay. Yeah.
Which makes sense. It was verified, but he was a veteran of tall sunflowers, so he had grown this twice.
What a title. Veteran of tall sunflowers.
Uh-huh. This particular sunflower, I found a picture of it. The man has scaffolding, like, holding this sunflower up as it is growing. It is taller
I was
than
ask
his
about
house.
That.
Yeah, it looks like he is scaffolding and then a ladder on the top part of the scaffolding holding up the sunflower.
Yeah, because often they'll grow in, like, they'll rely on each other for support somewhat, right?
A little, yeah.
Okay, so it makes sense that you might, at that height, you're pushing the bounds of what's possible. So having a having a scaffolding system there makes sense.
Yeah, so they'll rely on each other a little bit, but their stalks are sturdy enough. Like, I know you're familiar with, like, cup flower and how sturdy their stems and such are. It's very similar to that. I think cup flowers are somewhat related to sunflowers, actually.
Okay.
So other things that I wanted to talk about in relating to sunflowers and why they're so strange in the first place is, one, you are able to eat so much of the sunflower. Generally speaking, they're one of the most edible flowers out there. You can eat, if prepared properly, you can eat the stem, you can eat the petals, the flowers themselves, which are not the yellowish petals that we see. Flowers are actually the brown bits on the inside. Those are the flowers. The petals around it are just a radial to attract sunlight and bring it in. Each sunflower is actually thousands of sunflowers, little tiny flowers in the center, pollinating each other, cross-pollinating, because there's both male and female, and they're just...
And that's why you get so many seeds, and the seed head is each one of those seeds comes from one of the flowers, right?
Exactly. They are, so you can eat, you can eat that. You can, the leaves can be used to make tea, or you can even like use them as types of greens. The stalks are actually also able to be, eaten. Their roots can be used for food as
well.
I had
no idea.
Yeah. So they are super edible. You just have to be able to prepare the different parts, for eating, which is pretty wild. Wasn't expecting that when I was reading about sunflowers. The other thing that was wild to me, so sunflowers are already kind of cool. We don't really think of them as being as very like metal or crazy or anything like that.
Right. They seem pretty like, peace-loving, laid-back flowers.
Yeah.
Not so much, huh?
No. Oftentimes they can be considered, wild sunflowers are considered a weed for a lot of crop farmers just because they're found often, the wild ones are perennial and they're often found in like corn and soybean fields, and like that's not great for your farmers.
But, oh, so wait, so there's both perennial and annual sunflowers,
yes,
then? Okay.
It depends on the type of sunflower. But gotcha. What's really crazy to me, so if say you're outside of Chernobyl and you want to get rid of some of that nuclear fallout.
I mean, not on a daily basis, I'm usually not doing that, but hypothetically, okay, I'm with
hypothetically,
you.
Hypothetically, you could plant some sunflowers.
Could I?
You could. So sunflowers are actually able to extract pollutants from soil. A lot of different heavy metals, including lead, uranium, cesium, zinc, cadmium, very heavy metals. And they actually absorb those through the roots and just accumulate into like the shoots and the leaves and stuff. Obviously, don't eat those sunflowers.
Don't eat those. Those ones, yeah, not so much.
Those ones are bad. But it's taking them outside of the... outside of the environment itself and helping replace, like remove those from the environment, which allows us to be able to go into those spaces, allows the nature to be able to like come back from a nuclear fallout. There's actually been a campaign about planting a bunch of sunflowers for Chernobyl. And there was a similar one actually for the Fukushima nuclear disaster, of planting a ton of sunflowers in the area so that way it can help neutralize a lot of the really heavy metals.
Well, I think I recall that they actually normally grow a lot of sunflowers in Ukraine. So that would not be out of the ordinary to go plant some around Chernobyl.
No. So they've already been working on it and trying to help get some of those... some of those metals out, because it'll accumulate in the areas, but it'll fix it enough so that way they can actually be like processed and like taken out and not be, you know,
causing
radioactive
problem. Yeah.
Sunflowers. So that way it helps neutralize it, so you can take it out and just be like, ah, well, this is fine now. This won't exist over in this space. It'll be
sure,
okay.
If you harvest the crop, it has been, you know, pulled out of the soil and now is fixed into the plants.
Exactly.
So you still have to dispose of the plants then, but yeah.
Yeah. A couple other things before I end this. Sunflowers are also being looked at since they also produce latex.
Really?
Which a lot of folks are allergic to, including myself.
Yeah.
They are actually being looked into as an alternative for producing like a hyperallergenic rubber. So latex, for those who don't know, the main ingredient in rubber is latex, which comes from like rubber trees and things like that. And there's a lot of people who are actually allergic to latex, and it creates it to the point where it's like a hot,
it can be bad.
It can be really bad. Like my mom, for example, like this is a total side tangent, but my mom was anaphylactic. Like she couldn't even be in the same room as a rubber band, or she could like not breathe. It was bad. So having an alternative is great.
It's great. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
But to end this, I really wanted to just look at sunflowers themselves and the fact that they look so innocuous. There's so many little tiny flowers on them, and we all look at them and just like smile a little bit. Or I hope you all look at sunflowers and you smile a little bit, just because they remind you
of the
sun,
awesome.
Right? They're really pretty. They've been around for 5,000 years. But
well, been
general,
cultivated for that
they've
long,
been
right?
Cultivated like, for that long at the very least. Yeah. And they've been a part of the human history for so long.
Right.
The fact that we're still utilizing them as heavily as we are,
and in new ways,
they still bring us so much joy. Ugh, go plant a sunflower. It'll be great.
Nice. Well, yeah, up here, except for our Australian listeners, you know, it's probably a little late in the season. But for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, too, yeah, perfect timing.
Or start one by seed in your house.
No,
see
yeah.
how it goes.
Do that, too. Why not?
Bring yourself a little bit of sun in the wintertime for those who it is winter.
Anyone who does that, send us a photo. We will share it. We would love to see your sunflowers. That'd be so cool.
Oh, that would be so fun.
Rachel, right. I had no idea that sunflowers were going to be so strange.
Right? They seem like totally innocuous. And it's like, hold on, hold your hat.
And I love that both of our topics this week were things that were bigger than you expect.
Mm-hmm. Wild. I'm
still
gonna
can't get
if
over
I
the
can
30
hold
foot.
On to that picture of that one sunflower and post.
I want a picture of the 30 foot sunflower next to the, you know, 28 foot manta ray.
Yup.
Not the right habitat. You know, they're not compatible in that way, but unbelievable.
It's all good. Well, thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks everyone.
See you next week.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.